time is fine.
Yes, it's just I didn't want to wander too far off what you thought I ought to be talking about. That's why I want to question you first. Now you go ahead and ask questions.
This is Professor Wood, tape number one. Could you start off by telling me, Professor Wood, the very first things that happened at UBC and how you first arrived there?
Well, I first arrived because I happened to be in Victoria, having finished my MA at Harvard University. At the time, it was announced that the University of British Columbia would definitely open in September of 1915. And I was interviewed by Dr. Westbrook and appointed to the English department, being one half of it for the first 3 years that the university was in existence. And in those remote days, the arrival at university was not perhaps as easy or as comfortable as many students who go out in their own cars now to Point Grey find it. Those of us who didn't live, as the out-of-town students had to, in boarding houses in Fairview, lived in their own homes in different parts of town, and some of us approached each morning by way of the Fairview Beltline car, which is something that is vaguely remembered and fondly remembered by a lot of old Vancouverites. It was usually, through the winter, a dull, foggy morning, and the air in the car was heavy and unpleasant. And often we were put out at the corner of Willow and 10th Avenue, or Broadway rather, to find a funeral in progress, a 9 o'clock funeral at the corner of the street. In fact, there was a legend that one student, one out-of-town freshie who stayed out too late one night and was very sleepy in the morning of a 9 o'clock lecture, got off the car and followed a group of people, thinking he was on his way up the two board plank walk up to the university, but he found himself instead in the funeral parlor, which was dedicated to a different kind of sleep from the one he expected to have in his room, lecture room at the university. As one went up that walk of a block, we were often on a morning when the breeze was in the right direction, saluted by waves of ether from the operating room of the Vancouver General, which was just across the street. And the smell of ether was blowing at us. And then we turned off of Willow halfway between 10th and 11th. And on our left, behind a fence, was the tubercular annex of the General Hospital and the contagious diseases. The only aspect of a university that one got in that brief approach to the side entrance of what was then the arts building of the University of British Columbia was a glimpse of the cupola on the King Edward High School a block away, reminding one of the gray spires of Oxford against a pearl gray sky. First year, most of the lectures were in the three larger rooms that were designed for wards. This building, you see, belonged to the provincial government, was put up as a tubercular hospital. And the people living around in Fairview protested so wildly, like governments since. The one of Sir Richard McBride relented and turned over this building that had never been used to the university for what was thought a year or so, and it was the home, the main building of the university for just 10 years, because it was in the fall of 25 that we migrated to what was called the promised land. These large classrooms held as many as 40 students apiece, which in those days were very ample, and these rooms were very ample. The student body the first year numbered 379, and there were 27 of us on the staff. Needless to say, there was not much what is known as school spirit that opening year, but during the period in Fairview, I think the University of British Columbia developed the finest spirit that it's had in its 50 years of history. For one thing, we were all very close to one another, physically as well as in any other aspect. We couldn't escape each other because the buildings were small, although through those 10 years, Hottentot huts, as they were called, would appear through the summer with a sort of rabbit-like rapidity and were painted brown shingle stain and so got their name, Hottentot Huts. There were several of those through the years, and in the second year in Fairview, we had an auditorium built right on the corner of 10th and Willow, which was a great boon because after its arrival, we were able to have class parties in the main auditorium. It was used for convocations. By the way, the first convocation was a very grand one in the May of 1916. The first class, which is a very small one, graduated from the ballroom of the old Hotel Vancouver. The procession of principal figures on the staff and the graduating class lined up in the corridors of the courthouse and then coming out on the side nearest the present hotel, we went along Georgia Street past the water tank dedicated to King Edward VII and into the old hotel where graduation exercises took place. But after that, for 9 years, graduation was in the auditorium, which was built, as I say, 1 year after the university opened.
Excuse me, did they confer degrees during the first convocation?
Oh yes, because...
Honorary degrees?
No, there were no honorary degrees. I don't remember just when that came into it, when it was first introduced into the ceremonies, but not, I don't remember them in Fairview at all, but I may be wrong on that because it's a matter one doesn't recall. Our speakers for the address to the graduating students were usually brought in from other places. I remember twice the president of the University of Washington, a very distinguished scholar in his time, gave the address, but the general practice, I think, was not to have an honorary degree. Something else.
Well, now, excuse me, you were just discussing about 1916 on, the graduating ceremonies were held in the auditorium.
Another aspect of our early life there, not only were these Hottentot huts necessary, and they appeared each summer when we were not using the grounds, the new one would be built, but we passed through that stage of brown shingle life to what might be called our evangelical area of churches. We had first the First Baptist Church, which was a building very conveniently placed just a half a block down Laurel Street from one side of the university area, and another Anglican church up on about 15th Avenue. The Baptist church was used for, I would say, 6 or 7 years before we moved out to Point Grey, it finally became necessary to put a false ceiling in and an upstairs auditorium, as well as the main church downstairs. It was a wooden structure, a temporary one, as, of course, the church later migrated further away in a building that is still standing today. One of the difficulties was that sometimes on Sunday evenings, baptism took place in the church, and the person who lectured at 9 the next morning had to be careful that in the enthusiasm in presenting his subject, he didn't step backwards suddenly, because the janitor would forget to put the covering over this 6-foot-deep font. So that it was always a rather perilous situation if a baptism had occurred the previous evening. Yes, and we didn't have a cafeteria in those days. Students brought their lunches in bags, or a lot of them went home or to their boarding houses in the near vicinity. The lunch situation was saved by the IODE starting a cafeteria for returned soldiers who came back for short courses at the university to enable them to pursue some trade. They were there for perhaps parts of 2 winters. And a building down in a hollow between the Hottentot huts and the stone-faced arts building was put up by the university for the serving of these meals. After the returned soldiers had no longer the need, this building was turned over to the university and became our first cafeteria, with long tables, with oilcloth tops and benches. Just inside the door, several of those sort of cheap arrangements that they have in some of these restaurants along Hastings Street for heating up food were there. And hot-looking women would dish out things out of greasy saucepans, and that was the facility for lunch. However, we sat, faculty and students, on these benches and got to know our students in a familiar fashion, which was rather enjoyable.
Would you like to tell me about the first couple of days?
Well, now to answer that, after 50 years, it would be rather chancy. I do remember being taken up at 9 o'clock the first morning and introduced to my first class by the other half of the English department, the late Professor J. K. Henry, who was an uncle of a brilliant student who later on graduated from UBC and is now the Dominion archivist in Ottawa, Mr. K. Lamb. There were, as I have said, there were only 379 students, and most of them were of the female sex, because some 50-odd who had enrolled for that session were by that time training to go over to Flanders Fields, since the war was just in its second year. I feel that in those early days, students were very conscious of the worth of a university education and applied themselves. And then, too, we had a formidable thing called graduation at Christmas. Those who did not do well were politely and quietly asked to discontinue attendance at the university, and there were several gaps in the freshman class each January when we resumed after Christmas. There were very few of the activities that make for pleasure in a college course. That was one reason why I started the Players Club within a month after the university opened, because there were so few things that the students could do. There was no playing field and no gymnasium, so that some activities were necessary. And then a year after that, Professor Russell, who came over from Victoria at the time that I did, started a musical society, which has grown into the one that is still very prominent on the university campus. The rehearsals the first year for the Players Club had to take place at noon hour in small rooms that ordinarily would seat a dozen or so students for lectures. But nevertheless, we managed to get by, and the opening performance was the end of February that year at the Avenue Theatre on Main Street, now long since gone into the memory of old Vancouver people, just at the end of the Georgia Viaduct on Main.
What was the performance?
It was a play by the English playwright and writer of that period, Jerome K. Jerome, the author of Three Men and a Boat. The play was called The First Lady Bantock. Had 23 characters in it, and we all had a very good time and were requested by the president the next day to repeat the performance in New Westminster, in Vancouver, and in Victoria, thus beginning in a small way the annual tour of the Players Club. The proceeds were given to the 196th Western University Battalion that, as far as UBC was concerned, was that following summer to be encamped on the part of our property in Fairview that has since given home to hospital buildings, but was then free and under tents. These boys were in training, and the money from the first performances, out of other than the initial one, went into athletic equipment and that sort of thing to make life a little more interesting when they were not in drill.
And then what happened from the beginnings? Then you, when the veterans began to return, about 1918,
19? Oh, 90, yes. From 1918, some of those incapacitated for further service returned. And for the next 4 or 5 years, the campus was very much the better for the presence of these men who naturally had matured during the period that they were engaged in wartime activities. They had judgment and they had foresight, and UBC owed a great deal to them, and it was largely through their influence that the university was moved to Point Grey because of their administration of what was known as the Great Trek, and the planning that they put into it, and the energy with which they went about getting signatures from a great number of Vancouver people, presenting their case on the floor of the legislature in Victoria, and finally persuading a somewhat reluctant government that it was high time that the building, first building that had stood as a gaunt skeleton of iron and nothing more, steel rather, and nothing more, on the campus should be completed, and along with other so-called temporary buildings, and many of them are still giving good use to the present students of the university.
What can you describe from then, the 20s now, and then on into the 30s? Was it all smooth sailing from then on,
no.
Or what happened?
When you ask about what happened, I've forgotten to mention that much of the success of the few opening years of the university should be credited to the first principal, president of the university, Dr. Frank Westbrook, who had been dean of medicine at the University of Minnesota before he was appointed in 1913 to come out here and form plans for the university. Dr. Westbrook gave a great deal of thought to the selection of the heads of departments, to procuring, before the university opened, a 20,000 book library, which was brought out from the old country, bought by a librarian over there for that purpose. And his untimely death in the fall of 1918 was largely an effect of his overwork, because the man was only in his 50th year when he passed away. Then the gentleman who had been the original dean of the Faculty of Agriculture, Leonard S. Clink, was prevailed upon by the Board of Governors to take on the presidency, since he had served for some months after Dr. Westbrook's death as acting president. And Dr. Clink served the university well for nearly a quarter of a century. The life in Fairview, of course, was more and more eventful as the number of students increased, but the possibilities for any real academic life were rather hindered. Students studied and passed well and began to establish the reputation for good scholarship that is known now throughout America in reference to the University of British Columbia, but there wasn't a great deal of activity. One thing that was rather amusing, in the spring, the various classes had a relay race from the campus out to the university site in West Point Grey. The eight different sections were arranged, so that it was an eight-man team, and usually there were anywhere from 8 to 10 different classes or faculties. Agriculture and applied science usually had one entry only, whereas the different years in arts would be each enter. They raced in those days along 12th Avenue and then out University Avenue. The last spot where the seventh racer gave up to the finalist was a large stone on the right-hand side of the driveway going out in the university grounds, which bore the question in rather large painted sign, "Eternity Where?" And many of the people who used to turn out to that race and watch it in its various stages began to wonder Point Grey when, but finally, after the successful campaigning in 1923, the plans went ahead and we moved out there in the summer of 1925. In progress, various things naturally were lost, as often happen when even a household moves. And one of the things, or at least in the UBC one day, shortly after we opened on the campus, the editor was bewailing the loss of something and said, many things have been mislaid in moving, unfortunately not professors. Isn't that enough?
No, that's not enough. Is that your announcement, please? Mm-hmm. Any other tasty, or has it any special flavor or feeling that you one wouldn't find somewhere else?
No, I'm afraid I couldn't. You would be deleting some of this material. I don't think I could speak well on that subject because I haven't had contacts with other universities except in summer sessions before I married. Of course, I was free to go out for the summers, and I went to Columbia and Stanford and Berkeley different summers. But summer sessions, as you probably know, are not typical of student life. It's too bad Jeff Andrew isn't here because, of course, he spent 6 months at one time on some one of these commissions visiting universities in the States and abroad. From the point of view of, I see what you want, something covering the growth in that period. Have you yet talked with Harry Logan?
Can't get him. He's not home yet. He's away.
I knew he was going away shortly after I saw him 2 months ago. But is he not expected back?
They don't think he's expected back until quite late in September, around the 15th or so, which is, for the purposes of the program, going to make it. Do you want to turn that off?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it might help.
You can work it in if you want to. My first affiliations with the university were in Victoria, where I was one of the first class that took college work at what was then called McGill University of British Columbia, situated at Victoria, which came into being just 3 years after McGill had granted Vancouver High School the privilege of having university work done. There were seven of us in that first class, and one of them is now the Chancellor of the University of Victoria, Judge Clarihue, who went to McGill about the time I did. And two of the seven at different times have been voted Victoria's best citizen of the year. So I feel that that first class of seven must have established something to have. And in that way, I became interested in college work, and some 3 years later went on to McGill and for 3 years to complete my BA with taking honors in English. And after that I returned and taught for 4 years in Victoria High School. And it was after that I went to Harvard and came back to Victoria expecting to resume my work there when the chance to join the university staff presented itself.
University was of British Columbia was called McGill BC for how many years before UBC?
I think if you look in Harry Loden's book, you'll find that it McGill in Vancouver High School was granted the privilege in 99, and I think didn't start until a year or so later, but it had been doing it for 3 years before Victoria started its course in 1903. It was granted the privilege in 2002. And of course, in each case, the instructors were members of the high school staff, senior members, both in Vancouver and in Victoria. It wasn't a separate college staff, but the instruction was extremely good. And the institutions went on until the opening of the University of British Columbia, which carried through an agreement that McGill University presented when it made the offer that it would graciously withdraw when the University of British Columbia could come into being. So there were about 70 students enrolled for that fall in Victoria, and some 200 more over here, and they, of course, gave way later, Victoria College was reopened, of course, after the war years, and continued on until it became the University of Victoria some 2 years ago.
Yes, I'd read that in the book, but I wanted someone to say it.
Yeah.
Can you remember any interesting anecdotes about your teaching life when you were actually on the Point Grey campus from 25 on?
Well, it was a very busy life because the numbers of students grew rapidly each year. Of course, nothing like this 16,000 that they have now. Well, the thing I remember most is that towards the end of my 35 years as a member of the staff of the university, I became conscious of the lack of any close connection between students and faculty unless one were engaged in some student activity on the campus, in my case the Players Club, which I had finally to give up because of ill health. It was too demanding, and as much as I was doing it all in spare time, not a part of university lecture work. But one became not indifferent to students, but aloof from them through sheer necessity. I had classes in the English novel that some years numbered as many as 180. And naturally, I got to know very few of them unless they had conferences with me about their work. The old days in Fairview, when one knew students by their first names and they called professors by their first names behind their back. Oh yes, it was all done very...